has a ton in it. So we will try just to call out some of the highlights. I won't go through every pasuk by pasuk in the interest of time, but to start with the first pasuk, it starts Ve'ahav Yaakov es Rachel Ve'yomer Avadcha Shavashonim Berachel Bitcha Haktana. So here, Yaakov is still interested in marrying Rachel. I mean, is interested in marrying Rachel. So he says that I will work for her for 7 years so that you should let me marry her. So here, the whole arrangement is interesting. So first of all, committing yourself to 7 years of work, it's actually a halachic question nowadays, that there is a whole literature about Polim, that somebody whose work is on behalf of another. And a poel is different than an omen. An omen is taking on a specific task. A poel is basically selling his time. And selling one's time is actually tricky because it borders on avdus. Once you are giving over not your willingness to do a specific task, but basically all of your time. And Yaakov is held up in the Rambam and elsewhere as a role model for how he acted as a poel, for the sense of responsibility and commitment that he brings to what that means. But here there's a little bit of a halachic question, because there's a view of the Mordechai, it's quoted the halacha, that one should not commit himself to more than 3 years as a worker because of the concern that Kili b'nei Yisrael avadim lo avadim lo avadim, that we're not supposed to take on slavery anymore after we were freed from Egypt. We're only slaves of God. And because a poel has some uncomfortable commonalities with an eved, so we have limitations. So, for example, the Gemara says that poel yachol achzor afilu v'chatzi yom, that a poel can quit in the middle of the day because he has to have some degree of freedom, something that separates him from avdus. So, in that spirit, to commit yourself for too long of a time is cited as an issue. Of course, you know, what we have nowadays, there's a lot of contemporary literature about this, about signing a contract for more than 3 years. Nowadays, our whole work environment is very different. You're not really giving over your whole life and your whole time during whatever period you sign a contract for, so there's a lot of grounds to distinguish. But in any event, in the Sefer Paras Yosef, he talks about this issue, that is this a problem that, or is this surprising to us, that Yaakov would commit himself for 7 years in light of this limitation? So he notes that perhaps we find that there are certain things you're allowed to do for Parnassa, and this should be a Kal v'chomer from that. He's looking to get married. We know there's a notion you're allowed to sell a Sefer Torah, which you normally shouldn't do in order to get married. So perhaps that's the case here as well, that for this purpose, it was something he could go above and beyond what would normally be permitted. This last part of the pasuk has become an expression, say, Barachel Bitcha Ketana, that it's a way of conveying, maybe heard people use this in day-to-day speech, when they want somebody to be very specific about what they're talking about. They don't want any misunderstandings between the two parties. So expression is, make sure you get all the details, Barachel Bitcha Ketana. And the idea being that here Chazal tell us that this was, Rashi quotes, that this was Yaakov's way of saying, don't fool me with anything. That Hashem Atomer Rachel Acharis Min Ashok, right? Maybe you're going to switch her for some other Rachel. So Tamalomer Abitcha, that the emphasis is on your daughter. Hashem Atomer Achalif Lulea Shema, Bekra Shema Rachel. So maybe I will switch names of the daughters, and I'll switch her to Leah, and I'll just name her Rachel. So Talmud Lomer Haktana. So you see that you have to sometimes be very specific with people, and you have to account for every possible way that they could exploit any ambiguity in your sentence and trick you. So this has become an expression, quoting this context, that he going into all these details to try to cut off any possible misinterpretation or willful misinterpretation is what's being transmitted here. And then Rashi adds, you see, with all that, it didn't work. You know, he was still able to fool him anyway. It's interesting, I don't know what to make of this, But there is a discussion, it's on the Sefer Chmura Yitzchak, that focuses on the trough, that the way the Mercha and the Tipcha here is, so basically it reads, Berachel Bitcha Haktana. And you would have thought it would have been switched. You would have thought Berachel Bitcha Haktana, which would have had the connotation more that I'm interested in marrying Rachel. Who is Rachel? Rachel is your young daughter. So that's how it would have been read. But the way the Trap has it now, it's Berachel Bitcha Haktana, that as if he's saying, I want to marry your daughter Rachel. I want to marry specifically your daughter. So the emphasis on that is interesting. He discusses there, the Chmura Yitzchak discusses there, that this is because he was following the original tradition that he's supposed to, the instruction from his parents, that he's supposed to take a shidduch from that family, from the daughters of Laban. So that was what he was looking for specifically. So the idea he has to convey that to Laban is interesting. Maybe one could say that's also that undermined the whole thing, that that was what he picked up. Laban said, okay, so you want my daughter specifically. Okay, Leah's also my daughter. But one way or another, just an interesting thing to note, whatever you want to do with it, that the trap is phrased that way. So just to skip the pasuk off here. So there is a phrase here that's hard to understand. So the Yavod Yaakov Berachel Shavashanim, Yuve Einav Kiyav Machadim Avasu Osa. So he worked for her for 7 years, and because he loved her so much, it felt like it was just a few days. So that also seems a little bit hard to understand, because you would think the opposite, that if he was so in love with her, that it would be hard for him to wait, and that the waiting would feel like it was forever. And you would think of the other way around, that a few days would feel like years. So the idea that because he loved her so much, that the years felt like days, seems hard to understand. So the Chizkuni writes that maybe it seemed like a bargain. The point was, okay, for her, 7 years, that's nothing. That feels like that's just a few days. Not that the experience went by quickly, but that it seemed like it was a good deal. Or he writes also that maybe afterwards it felt like it was all a flash, but at the time, certainly it was very hard for him to endure. Hi?
This might just be like wrong, but I separating from that, Mefarash, I think I remember hearing somewhere that it was like one of those times where the chronology of the Torah is not exactly what it was, and they got married towards like earlier on in the 7 years.
Well, I think we might be thinking of after Leah, second time around.
Oh, okay.
So we'll get to that, because that's okay. That comes. So, but here also, there's another interpretation. Rav Sternbach in a Sefer Al Torah, Sefer Tam Vidas, so he has interesting perspective, and maybe this draws upon a little bit about what we heard during our discussions before, that because Yaakov was focused on the spiritual potential of this shidduch, so he realized he needs to prepare, he needs to be in the right place. So however much time he has in order to do that is something that he recognized he has to cherish every minute, because that's all a part of the preparation in order to be in the right spiritual place. So we heard some of you talk about how maybe if this is your last year in yeshiva, you need to try to make the time count and need to make sure that everything is going to be all that it can be. So when you have an appreciation for how much you need to accomplish spiritually within a short period of time, so that creates the mindset where it actually flies by too quickly, because you have such an awareness of what needs to happen during that time. Okay, so just to skip ahead a little bit, let's go to Pasuk Chafei. Can't read every Pasuk because there's so much to say. But so it turns out, as we know, there was a switcheroo here, Vahipa Boker, Vihine, Hilea, the Yomer Lava, Mazoso, Sicily, Lovarochel, Aditi Moch, Lavama Rimisani. So I don't understand what happened here. So it turned out that she was switched, it was Leah. So, first of all, it's an interesting question why this even counts. That if you marry somebody under false pretenses, you would think it's a mekach tos, you thought you were under the chuppah of a different person. And it turns out that you were wrong, you were fooled. So it's a question, why would it even be that there's any validity to this marriage?
Yeah? I mean, why are we assuming this is a valid transaction?
I mean, maybe it wasn't really a marriage?
I'm not saying love and death.
Well, it wasn't right what he did. The question is that why should the marriage even count? Right? Not that it should be mutter, but why should the marriage even be chal? I was actually thinking this morning a different context. Some rabbanim, when they officiated a wedding, so they want to prompt the chazan and how to say hariyat mekudeshesli, and they're afraid, you know, they don't want to be like they're saying hariyat mekudeshesli, so they say, you know, they say something like, so say hariyat mekudeshes. I've heard stories, hariyat mekudeshes. Okay, now say we. He doesn't want to say the sentence as he's saying it, and the chazan repeats after him. Now say we. The point is that he should say we without the now say. But you know, it's hard to imagine the problems because the cow is going to accidentally marry the Masada Kedusha. And so, you know, presumably she has to know who she's marrying. So the fact that the Masada Kedusha may say the phrase and say it all, so it's not like it's very unlikely that the cow is going to say, okay, you know what, I prefer him. So it's going to create problems. Murder's not his anyway. But so here also, so if there's a switch that he doesn't know about, so why should that be chal? Right.
Cool. It's also, I guess, this is sort of part of like the Mita connected Mita nature of what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also should just be just as true as the bracha for Yaakov, that Yitzhak gave a bracha they really intended to Esav to the wrong dude. So why should the bracha be
so, right,
followed
and,
at all?
And that is an interesting question, and that is a lot to talk about, but that is something that's in the Sfarim talk about with Kukas, a piece about that we didn't talk about last week because it wasn't in our Aliyah. But that is a valid question, and you're right, it presents another parallel between that story and this story, but it doesn't answer it though. Just leave it.
Later, what I said about him
goes on him. But the question was just the whole false pretenses at the beginning. So, you know, how does that, like, how was that supposed to work? So, essentially, you could ask the question. It does bring about a certain parallel, but it doesn't necessarily help us. But you're right that it does, and we'll get into a little bit more about that. So, the Talmud Das talks about this also. And he suggests that when he saw that she had the simanim, so then he was going to ask he should marry her also. But he still said to Lavan that why did you fool me? Because why did you bring this about in a false way? And that he did love her also, but he loved Rachel more. The Rishonim also talk about this, and they say that because Yaakov did suspect this might happen, because that was how this whole scenario was framed already, the whole point about Bitrachtana, as we noted, that he suspected something like this could happen. But he didn't want to be las nus. He didn't want to have an immoral situation. So he had intent that whoever she is, it should be chal, and be aware of the fact that it may theoretically be switched. And he said, why did you fool me? Lamer Nisani. So Maritz Dushinsky has a comment over here that sounds like a funny thing to ask, because, you know, as a the story goes, Lavan would probably say, you know, that's my nature. I'm a rabbi. Why are you asking me? Why would I fool you? That's what I do. I'm a fooler. So he suggests that really Yaakov was actually being clever himself by putting it this way, because he was afraid that now he wants to marry Rachel, that Lavan's going to up the price. So he was trying to say that, no, I'm actually happy about this. I like way even better. I would have married her anyway. So why did you have to fool me? You could have just come straightforward, and I would have married her also. And he was saying that in order to preserve his leverage. Now, as Zach was noting, so in the Bereishis Rabbah, there is a parallel drawn here between this episode and what happened with Parshas Toldos. And that Leah says to Yaakov, you know, basically, now you know how it feels. That they say, I did to you what you did to your father. And that's a very striking parallel. And it brings up the whole question also of how to relate to that story in last week's Parsha. Itself a big discussion way outside of our scope. But Rav Rivlin, who was the Mashkiach in Karen Biavna for many years, has a Sefer Al-Torah where he highlights the fact that this shows that even if we work under the assumption that what Yaakov did with the brachos was appropriate and necessary, but still, it's what we call an aveira l'shma. It was an aveira, even if it was for good reasons. And therefore, it also needs a kapara, that also needs to have an atonement. And that's what's being reflected here in the Netziv, in his commentary, extra commentary, the Chumash Neherchav Dover. The Netziv writes that, you know, there, once you have a situation like this, an aveir lishma, so you get caught on little details. So the idea that Yaakov did what he had to do, that's one thing. But Esav was crying about it, and Yaakov was apparently okay with that. So that becomes now a bigger indictment. and he needs a kapara for that. Okay, so in this next pasuk, Chavav, so Lavan says, "V'yomer Lavan lo ye'asa chayim b'mekomenu laseis hatzira lefnei habechira." Now we don't do that here. This idea of marrying off the younger before the older, so we don't do that. So that's an interesting question. This whole idea that there's something improper of a younger sibling marrying before an older sibling. So once again, turn to Rav Stern Bar Sefer Tam Vadat. So he questions that. Okay, but Lavan knew that before. Presumably, he knew which of his daughters was older and which was younger. So he already had agreed to this beforehand. Why didn't he bring that up then? So he thought that maybe the idea was that at first he thought actually that Leah should marry Esav. But then he found that afterwards about the switch to Bechorah, and that's where he now all of a sudden had this Kveda. So this is a question in general. Is this something that we incorporate into Halacha, this idea that there should be a Kveda, that the younger sibling shouldn't get married before the older sibling? So there is a discussion about this in Poskim, Tosus, that has what to say about this in Kedushin. And what's most well known is Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva about this, where he writes he thinks it's not an issue at all, and that the younger sibling can get married before the older one. The older one has no right to be immaculate, has no right to interfere. There were those who were not so sure. There's a tshuva about this in the Tshuvas Avnei Chayfetz. I was talking before about Rabbi Aaron Levine. So the Tshuvas Avnei Chayfetz was written by Rabbi Aaron Levine, who was the grandfather of the one I was referring to, Rabbi Aaron Levine, who was a teacher here. So his grandfather, Rabbi Aaron Levine, was known as the Reish Rav in Poland. He was a big Talmud Chacham, was also the member of the Polish Parliament. And he wrote a number of Svarim. So in his Tshuvas Avnei Chayfetz, he is not so sure about this. And there's a whole discussion of Poskim, if there is a Kepeda, is it the same for boys and for girls? There's a lot written about this. But Lamaisa, nowadays, we generally assume, like Rav Moshe, that we don't interfere with the Shidduch of a younger sibling just because it comes before an older sibling. And the Paras Yosef, he discusses that, just to connect this a little bit to Bava Basra and what we've seen so far in the first parak, that maybe his statement of Le'asa Kendim Komenu is to say that this is the local minig, that the minig has a status, and that that can override a Tanai. So if we have a condition, but there's a minig against it, so then the minig should prevail. And that was actually a machlokas to a shach and a sma about that question, about the role of minig in overriding a Tanai. And perhaps that is what he was reflecting here. So that's also interesting. Al pi derech something, not even drush, but to take the words out of the context, but there's a story, it's worth knowing, that especially nowadays, the whole shidduch process has become so commodified and so business-oriented and so it made it such a whole enterprise. So a part of it has become the new phenomenon that there has to be a resume and there has to be a picture. So there's a story that was related in the name of the Chibin HaRav, actually the name of the wife of the Chibin HaRav. The Chibin HaRav is Dov Barish Wiedenfeld, who was a great Gaon, lived in Eretz Yisrael in the second half of the last century, the author of Dov Nisharim. So there's a story that's related that he tried to suggest a shidduch to a young man, and this young man insisted on seeing a picture. And the Rabbitson overheard this, and she objected, and she quoted this pasuk that this isn't what we do. Laseis hasira lefnei habechira. That if you pronounce it in Yiddish, so Hebrew with a Yiddish pronunciation. Sorry,
like a hatsiura.
Right. So basically, what he was saying, it's actually Hebrew with Yiddish pronunciation. So it's as if it said, "This is not what we do in our place." Laseis hatsura lefnei habechira. That we don't show you the picture before we show you the girl herself. That's not what we do here. So pronounced in the Yiddish pronunciation, Surah Bachura, come out, we don't do that here. So, again, I don't think it even counts as drush necessarily, but the story is worth it because, again, our culture has moved very far from that sensitivity, so it's worth repeating that story and being aware that that was her objection. Okay, so the next pasuk is also interesting. Pasuk Chav Zayin, Malei Shavua Zos. V'nitnu lecha gam es zos ba'avoda asher ta'avod imadi od shalosh shanim acheros. So here he said that fill out this week and I will give you the other daughter as well for another 7 years of work. So, Max, this might be what you're referring to before, that this is possible to misunderstand. It sounds like he worked 7 years for Rachel and Galeh, and then he had to work another 7 years to, and then marry Rachel. But that's not how it happened. He actually was able to marry Rachel right afterwards, and then he still had this debt of the 7 years to work after that. But he was able to marry Rachel almost immediately, not actually immediately, because as Malei Shavua Zos, you have to wait a week. So why do you have to wait a week? So the Yerushalmi understands from here, Yerushalmi and Moy Katan understands from here a din of Eim Arvin Simcha B'Simcha. We know that, for example, if somebody was to get married on Yantif, that'd be a prohibition. It's a little counterintuitive. It's a good trivia question. What's the one thing that's more usher to do on Chol HaMoed than on Shabbos? If you get married on Shabbos, so that is Nisad Rabbanan. It's a gezerah. But to get married on Yantif is Nisad Daraisa, and even if it was Chol HaMoed, it would be Nisad Daraisa. So what's that? That's because of the mitzvah of Simcha on Yantif. And the Gemara understands that there's a prohibition, Eim Arvin Simcha B'Simcha. So the Talmud Babli understands that from the Pasuk, V'samachta B'Chagecha, V'Chagecha B'lo B'Ishtecha. You should be rejoicing in the Yantif, and you shouldn't dilute that with your personal happiness of your wedding. But the Talmud Yerushalmi in Moed Katan learns it from this Pasuk, that what happened here was that, okay, he was able to have another wedding right after he had a wedding to somebody else, but you have to at least space it out. You have to have the Sheva Brachos, for one, finished before you take on the Sheva Brachos of the other one. So you didn't have to wait a full 7 years, but you had to wait 7 days in order to create that space. Hi.
So, I mean, that's the question. My understanding is that this pasuk is also one of the sources for the idea of Sheva Brachos in general.
So that's a... Sheva Brachos we relate to as Adid Rabbanan, so Takana, very old in Rabbanan, Takana of Moshe Rabbeinu. But the Gemara quotes it for this purpose, the Yerushalmi quotes for this purpose, to say that we shouldn't mix the two, so we should create a space for the whole Simchas Nisuin, and only then have another marriage. Now, it's interesting that Torah Tamima notes that that actually makes it more chamer than Yantif, because in the case of Yantif, you're not allowed to get married on Yantif, but you can get married on Erev Yantif, that's explicit in the Gemara. So we can let the Sheva Brachos overlap with Yantif, which is the wedding itself. So here, we're saying that when it comes to two weddings, so then you have to let the whole Sheva Brachos finish. Not that you just can't have two weddings at the same time, you have to, can't dance at your own two weddings, but you have to wait for the whole Sheva Brachos to be over before having the next weddings. That's actually more chamer than the issue we would have by Yantif. So the Torah Tamima suggests that maybe when it comes to mixing weddings, it's more, as you can imagine, that's more of a potential combustible combination, and that could create the real jealousy issues, and therefore that's a bigger problem. So there's a whole discussion about this. It's interesting to compare the two. Now, you might suggest that this is a little bit surprising, because the idea that the Talmud Yerushalmi should quote this for the halacha. So who's the Rebbe here? Right? The Rebbe is Lavan. So Lavan wouldn't seem to be such a good source of chachma that we should assume that we should quote from him. And you could have asked this question also on the previous point, that to the extent that we do have any attitude that the Shiduchim should go in age order, which so was controversial, but to whatever extent his attitude is adopted there, the question could also be asked, but why, to what extent should Lavan be considered our Rebbe? That seems to be a little surprising. So Lutzke Rav in the Italian Torah, so he writes that Lavan was just saying something that he knew that Yaakov would appreciate, that Yaakov would care about, so he was prompting that point. But there is another approach to this. You can find two places quote the same idea, that you can find this in the introduction to the Paradis Yosef, where he makes a point like this. And the and also in the Baruch She'emar. The Baruch She'emar is the commentary on the Siddur. It's also by the same name on Pirkei Avos. that was written by the author of the Torah Tanima. So a minute ago we mentioned the Torah Tanima and that sefer. So the same author, Baruch Levi Epstein, wrote a sefer, Baruch Shamar, on the Siddur and on Pirkei Avos. So he talks about this in the beginning of the Siddur. So why does he talk about it there? It's a Baba Basra reference, or a Baba Basra connection. Right, what have we been talking about in the context of Hezekiah? Who do we cite in that context? Bilam, right? So the Dematovo Halach Yaakov, that we quote him as instructing us on the value of privacy between homes, and we start off our davening with him. We quote him at the beginning of our day, and so at the beginning of the Siddur, Torah Tamima talks about that. And the Marshal actually in the Tshuva writes that he did not say Matovo for that reason. So he had a different practice, but most of us do say Matovo. So the question of why that should be, in light of the fact that we're quoting somebody who seems to be an unsavory character, why should we quote from Bilam? Why should we quote from Lavan? So the Torah Tamima talks about it there, and the Paris Yosef in his Hakdama, he has the same word. And they both ask a question that's not necessarily the kind of question that has to keep you up at night, but it's the kind of question you'd ask if you have an answer. So if you want to say a Dvar Torah, you ask this question. So the steer is that the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, Izehu Chacham, Halomid Mikolagam. Who is wise? Somebody who learns from everybody. But the Gemara says in Talmud, Izehu Chacham, Haroah Sanolad, which we often understand to mean that somebody who's able to anticipate what's going to happen, is able to follow through the consequences of something. So that person is considered to be a Chacham. So it's a steer. So which one is it? Is a Chacham Haroah Sanolad, or is it Halomid Mikolagam? Again, I don't know if that's the kind of question that would really keep you up at night. They could both be chachamim, but the Paris Yosef and the Torah Tamima, they both give the same answer, that maybe it doesn't mean haroah sanolad, that he anticipates what's going to happen, but haroah sanolad means that when you look at an idea, there's two components. There is the idea itself and the one who creates the idea. So the one who creates the idea, that is the molid. And the idea itself, that's the product, that's the nolad. So when the Mishnah says, Ezehu Chacham Halomed Mikol Adam, it means that if the Chacham is there, so then you should take it, even if you don't like the person who's saying it. So the real Chacham is Roes HaNolad, he doesn't pay attention so much to the molad. So if the idea is good, he'll take it. He's not going to say, well, I don't like the person who said it. So that's what they suggest, that there's a harmony between the two ideas. They're both about taking the Chacham from wherever it comes. And therefore, if Bilam says something wise, or Lavan says something wise, okay, so then we'll recognize that. And we will take that into consideration. So, okay, so this is what happens, as the pasuk goes on to describe. V'yas Yaakov Kain, v'yamalei shavuazos, v'yitein vo, it's Rachel bita lo Yisha, right? So it's explicit that they got married right afterwards, and he married the sister. So as the Ramban and others raise the question that this seems to contradict the idea, which is actually sourced in last week's parasha, Parshas Toldos, that we have that the Avos kept the entire Torah. So this is a problem because by Torah law, one is not permitted to marry two sisters during their lifetimes. If one sister passes away, so then you can marry the other sister. But two sisters during a lifetime, even if there's a divorce, if they're both alive, then you can't marry a second sister. So how could it be that Yaakov marries two sisters, the Avos kept the Torah, and this is against Torah law? So this the Ramban already asks, and he discusses that maybe this was only observed in Eretz Yisrael, and that maybe it's taka why Rachel died before coming back into Eretz Yisrael, because then it was going to be a problem. And there are other answers. There's a lot of literature about this. I thought that the approach you could say here is that the Avos, when they kept the Torah, so keep in mind, they didn't have the Torah. They weren't instructed, and they weren't mitzuva in the Torah. They kept the Torah without instruction. So how did they do that? They did that presumably because they were able to figure out what the values of the Torah were. They were able to figure out what the Ratzon Hashem is, and they observed it. So normally, when we have a mitzvah from the Torah, so we're not allowed to decide on our own whether the reason applies or doesn't apply, and therefore make the halacha conform to that. And we say that ein dorshin taimid dekra, that it's not our job, not our prerogative, to interpret what a pasuk means and to develop the halacha lakula based on that. However, that shouldn't apply to the avos, because it applies to us because we have a tzivoy, we have a din in the Torah, so we have to keep it whether or not we think the circumstances apply. But if they didn't have a tzivoy in the first place, they were doing it because of the time of the kra, the time of the mitzvah. They were observing the mitzvah in the first place because they figured out what it should be. So it follows they should also be able to figure out what the exceptions would be. That's also part of the whole process that got them there in the first place. So if that's the case, so then maybe you could say that Yaakov figured out he's allowed to marry two sisters because the notion of not marrying two sisters is really in his understanding because they're going to fight. There's going to be machlokas. And therefore, if he could understand that with these two sisters, you're not going to have machlokas, that here you see that Rachel gave Leah the simanim, you see this, that kind of a cooperation between the two sisters. So this is a very special pair, and he doesn't have to worry there's going to be machlokas between them. Now, is that 100% a secure presumption? So we'll see from the psukim later that maybe not so much. But at least initially, it seemed reasonable for him to decide that these two sisters are not going to be fighting, and therefore he can carve out an exception to this rule. And again, we couldn't carve out any exceptions because ain't there some time of the Krah. But he didn't have a tzivoy, the whole thing was coming from the time of the Krah, so he should be able to decide on his own what the exceptions might be. This is also related to something earlier in the parsha, that if you assume that the Avos kept the Torah because they figured out what the Ratzon Hashem was, and some point out that that's the connotation, and Parsha told us in the first Aliyah, the Pasuk is Ekev Asher Shama B'Koli, that Abraham heard God's voice. It's not here to Tzivoy. He heard Tzivoy, he would say Likoli, that he listened to what I said. But Bikoli means that he listened to the intent, that he was able to discern what the Ratzon Hashem was and to fulfill it. So there is a theory that the whole notion of rabbinic law is based on that. That we've mentioned in the past, the Rambam says rabbinic law is binding because of the pasuk of law saser, we shouldn't deviate from that which the rabbis say, and the Ramban disagrees. So the question is, if the Ramban doesn't think it comes from that pasuk, or really any pasuk, so what obligates us to listen to rabbinic law? So Rabbi Wasserman, in his Kuntres Divrei Sofrim, he says that according to the Ramban, it's because we are recognizing that what the Chazal were able to do is to discern the real Ratzon Hashem in between the lines of the explicit Torah. And they figure out that the Ratzon Hashem are all these additional rules and they convey them to us. So then we follow the rules appreciating that. So if that's the case, so we follow rabbinic law because Chazal tell us that's Ratzon Hashem. And the Avos fulfilled the Torah before it was given because they figured out Ratzon Hashem. So maybe there's a parallel to be drawn between rabbinic law and the way the Avos related to mitzvos before the Torah. So based on that, the Sefer Eish Tamid, which is written by a very fine Talmud Chacham, Shlomo Sinemin, Shlita, the Rebbe in Tar Vadas, so he notes that if we really draw a comparison between the two, so when it comes to rabbinic law, the principle of the Nesivos HaMishpat is that if you violate rabbinic law inadvertently, so it's a shogeg, so then that doesn't require any kind of a kapara, it doesn't require any atonement, because when it comes to Torah law, so Torah law is inherent, and therefore if you violate Torah law, if you do it on purpose, there is an onesh. But if you do it even inadvertently, there's often a kapara, there's often something that needs to be fixed because of the impact that has on the neshama. But rabbinic law, so there, it's more about listening to rabbinic instruction. It's about not rebelling against the rabbis. So if that's the case, so then if you were unaware that you were violating it, so you don't have any conscious rebellion, so then that's what the Nesivos is saying, you don't have to fix anything. So, based on that, Rabbi Sinna noted that at the beginning of this week's parasha, so we find that Yaakov falls asleep and he has this dream, and he says afterwards, "Achein yesh Hashem b'makom hazav anochi lo yadati," that I didn't know that God is in this place, and if I did, what would it have done differently? So Sama Rishonim understand that he wouldn't have gone to sleep because it was a holy place, so he felt bad that he slept in a holy place. So this Eish Tamid asked the question that by Din Rabbanan, if it was inadvertent, so then there's no need to fix it afterwards. So the fulfillment of the mitzvos by the avos before the Torah was given should be treated like a Din Rabbanan, and if you violated it by accident, you shouldn't have to feel bad. You shouldn't have to do any kapara. So I think that it's actually different, that the emphasis of the nesivos is that because we relate to it as loyalty to Chazal, we don't want to rebel against Chazal, so then that becomes the thrust of it. So if you're not rebelling because it was inadvertent, so you don't need a kapar. But here, they didn't have it sivui at all, the Avos. They didn't have any commandments, just they figured out on their own that this is what's kedai to do. And therefore, since they realized it was a value, so even if you inadvertently missed out on that opportunity, or you violated that principle inadvertently, so that's something also to feel bad about. Okay, so let's try to get a little bit more in. So if you look at Pasuk Lamed, so can continue Chav Tesa Lamed, Vayitem Laban L'Rachel Bito, Espila Shifchaso, La'la Shifcha, V'yavo Gam El Rachel, V'yahav Gam Es Rachel, Mileo, V'yavod Imo Od Shevashanim Acheros. Okay, so here we see that he loved Rachel more than Leah. So as Rav Schwab notes, that it sounds like this contradicts other psukim, because to say that he loved Rachel more than Leah, so it sounds like he loved Leah also. But elsewhere the psukim say that Leah was snua, she was hated. So how is it that those can be reconciled? Was she hated or was she just loved less? So that's an interesting discussion, especially the whole idea of Yaakov hating Leah seems very strong and out of character. So there are various interpretations of this. I remember there was a professor who passed away a few years ago, Professor Zubin, Svi Zubin, guys used to go visit him and learn with him. And he conveyed in those sessions that the language of snua, what we translate as hatred, it doesn't necessarily actually mean hatred. It means less preferred, and that can be upheld in various contexts. In the context also of Kiseitse, when it talks about the Bechor of the two wives, that it doesn't necessarily mean hated. And remember darshaning after that, but also sinas chinam doesn't have to mean actual hatred. It can mean just deprioritizing somebody. But that was his whole mahalath there, so that would make it consistent that she was less preferred than Rachel, but she wasn't hated, so she was snua in that context, but she's still beloved. Rav Schwab has a different spin on this idea. He says that when it comes to a wife, so loving anyone more than a wife is considered like hatred, because the love is supposed to be at the highest level. So yes, if I have two friends and I love one more than the other, it doesn't mean I hate the other friend. But, you know, a wife in a spousal context, to love her anything less than more than anyone else is already a very negative situation. Right? That's why when we talk about God and the Jewish people, we have the muscle of Erison to make that point. Yes, sir?
That's also the day of the Radak and a Yesh Omrim in the Ramban on this pasuk as well, that it's possible that snua just means like love less, so it's, you know,
the lesser degree.
It's yeah. not with all due respect to, you know, the professors, you know, yeah, the Rishonim already, you know,
right? No, I hear you. He expressed it through a whole analysis of usage and all the different things, which is why he came in through a whole linguistic presentation where he wrote up in the context of the Sukkim and Kiseitse even before, and a few other points and emphasize that idea. But yes, it's true. Also, you can see it in earlier sources here as well. And the idea of snua is brought up in the next pasuk, right? So pasuk lamed aleph. So the language is v'yar Hashem ki snua leah v'yiftach es rachma v'rachel akara. So as some kind of compensation for the fact that she was unpreferred, so she became fertile and she started having children, as opposed to Rachel. So the Emes Yaakov, Yaakov Kamenetsky, suggests here, based on the Pesukim of Rav Kahana, that originally Leah was also Achara, she was also barren, but as a compensation, because God saw that she was in such a sad position, she was Snua, so it was changed. The Ramban writes over here that Yaakov had negative feelings to her because of the whole deception. So to counterbalance that, so Hashem gave her the kids so he wouldn't divorce her. And he would appreciate that. So the next pasuk tells us, Matar Leah v'teilet bein, v'tikra shmo Ruvain, ki amra ki ra'a Hashem ba'anyi, ki ata yehavani ishi. So she called him Ruvain because she said that God saw my suffering and now my husband will love me. So the Pnei Yeshua notes that this contradicts the Gemara, or by the other way around, the Gemara contradicts the Pesukim, because the Gemara, the first part of Brachas in Dav Zayin, the Gemara says that Reuven's name connotes a different thing, that Reuven, Leah was saying, Ra'ah ma bein b'ni l'ben ben chami, so l'ben ben chami, see what the difference is between my son, Reuven, and the son of my father-in-law. Meaning she was contrasting Esav and Reuven. She's saying that Esav loses the Bechara to Yaakov and he goes nuts about it. While Reuven will lose his stature to Yosef and he'll be okay with it. So it seems like that's contradicted by this pasuk. Pasuk gives us a different reason. So Rav Dushensky in a sefer, Marietzi writes, it's really the same thing. This is just the Gemara is giving a more elaborate version. That here the pasuk says Leah is saying that Yaakov will love her for this child, and what she means in the Gemara is that when Yaakov will see what a good job I do raising him and his midos and his appreciation, so then he will love me. The Paras Yosef adds that this was her way of also reminding Yaakov of the crying that she did over Esav, over the initial impression that she was going to have to marry Esav, and that would also show her worthiness. Yaakov should have an appreciation for that. The Liskarov, the Znaim Lutara, adds that, he says that as well, but he also adds that her invoking Esav was not to compare and to insult Esav, to be miskavi b'kol chavero, but she was also being moda, that she was saved from that, that the idea that she was initially supposed to marry Esav, and she was rescued from that situation, so that's something that she was expressing hodah for. I remember hearing many years ago from Rabbi Yisrael Reisman that he was discussing some of the questions related to naming children. And he discussed the issue that sometimes there's a family pressure to name your child after a certain relative. And you're okay with the name, but you don't like that relative. It's not somebody who you want to have as the namesake for your child. You don't really respect this person, and you don't want the child to have a name after that relative. So sometimes what they advise is that you should have in mind a different person who has that name who you do look up to, and you'll have that in mind when you name the child that same name, and everyone else will think that it's for that relative in Shalom Al Yisrael. So he said there that when he gives this Eitzah, so people inevitably ask, but Rabbi, does that work? Whatever it means for it to work when you name somebody, so is that going to be effective? So he said, you have a proof here from Leah, because what about this contradiction? That here the Torah says that it's this idea that, okay, my husband will love me now. And the Gemara gives you this whole other story about comparing Reuven to Esav. So what about this contradiction? So he explains that what she really had in mind was what the Gemara says. This whole comparison that her son, you'll see in the future, is going to be better than Esav, that was what she really had in mind. But she couldn't say that at the bris. Couldn't give that speech in front of people at the bris. So what they said, the official party line, was what's recorded there. That she said, that, look, okay, this is it. Which also, maybe isn't the most pleasant thing to be airing out, but okay, it doesn't have some of the same complexities of the story with Esav. But what she was really thinking was that, and he brought that as a riot to this idea, that, okay, you can have one thing in mind and have another thing being the stated reason, and whatever that means, it works. All right, so we're almost out of time. Just to quickly look at some of the other psukim, there's so much more in this aliyah, so we wouldn't get to cover all of it. But to look at pasuk Lamed Dalet. So just skip to that for a second. The birth of Levi. It says, Kilarati lo shloshavanim, alkein karishmo Levi. So now she say, okay, this one will do it, and she has birth of Levi. So Rashi notes that it says karishmo Levi. All the other pesukim says tikra. So he quotes the Medrash Haggadah that when he was born, Gavriel Hamalach came down and he called him this and gave him all the Chavdalei Matnas Kahuna. So therefore his name was called Levi, not the same way that the other Pesukim suggest. Yaakov Kamenetsky writes in the Emes to Yaakov that Yaakov saw this whole thing going on, so he wanted to be in on the name because that would, this child's going to follow on his path of the Avoda, so he gave him that name to represent that. And then Leah saw this and she gave him this name for her reasons. Okay, another pasuk that is quoted very often. There's a song based on this, maybe? Maybe not, but that's pasuk certainly well known. Pasuk Lamed Hey, to skip to that one. Vataro Vatelet Bain, Vatomer Hapam Oda Sasha. Right, just not right. Right, it's the song. So now I will thank God. So okay, and Kurashmo Yehuda, Vatama Miladis. That was it. She didn't have children anymore. She stopped having children. So this name is obviously important to us because we take his name, the Jewish people, the Jews are Judeans, so we're named after Judah. So the notion of being able to be Moda, and it's going to come up again and again, that Yehuda himself was Moda, and the whole story with Tamar, and that's considered to be a great credit to him. So the significance of this name is great, but here it represents not his Hodah, but his mother's Hodah, Leah's Hodah. She says, now I will thank God. And the Gemara and Brachas on Dav Zayin, same Gemara we just referenced before. So the Gemara says that no one thanked God before Leah came along. So that's hard to see because we do have instances of others in Tanakh being Moda to God before this. So the different explanations were, Schraub writes that in general everything before this included some prayer about the future when she named the previous children, and here she was just happy and thought, okay, I have everything I need, I'm not looking for anything more. So that's the specific type of hodah that it's highlighting, not just any kind of hodah, or that maybe it wasn't for the specific aspect, but it was just on getting a gift from God, so therefore that is what is being highlighted here. The more well-known explanation, which is often cited, is that the Matar Tamima has like this, and the Tam Bedas also has like this, is that Leah knew, Meruach HaKodesh, that there was going to be 12 Shvatim, so 4 mothers and 12 Shvatim, so that should be 3 for every mother. So when she saw that she had a 4th son, she realized that she was getting more than what would have been the average portion. So that was a real hodah to recognize that she's getting more than she thought she was due. So the Gemara is emphasizing that that should be what all hodah is, that not just the fact that she only came onto it for the 4th son, but that that attitude she had then should be the attitude she should have for everything. And to be able to be moda to recognize that this is not coming to us and that this is a special bracha, that should be the spirit of hodah. And the Sefer Paris Yosef, he quotes from Rabbi Bishcharif, who is the author of the Sefer Tevgitin, that Hodah means that when you thought something, I guess in a sense of also admission at the same time, that when you thought something was bad and it turned out to be good, so that's specifically appropriate to call it Hodah. So here, you know, because she, especially if you follow what we said a few psukim ago, that she was originally not going to have children at all, and because she had this new status, so then that led to now not only having children but more than her share, so that gives a special appreciation for what Hodah is able to reflect. So there's so much more in Zaliyah that we're not going to get into. Just quickly note, so the whole story of what's the Parak changes here in Parak Lamed, so then we see that, first of all, like I said before, the idea that there'd be no jealousy between Rachel and Leah was maybe overly optimistic because it's contradicted by this pasuk, and pasuk Aleph says, Vateri Rachel ki lo yalda Yaakov, Vatikani Rachel Bachosa. There was a jealousy between them now. But Tomer Yaakov, Hava livanim, v'im ayin mesa anochi. Give me children. And if not, then I'm going to die, or I might as well be dead. Rashi says, I might as well. So the next pasuk tells us that Yaakov gets very upset. He says, Vayichaf Yaakov Barachel. The Yomer HaSacha said, Lokim Anochi Asher, Manim Imchafi Rotten. He gets very upset. And the Mefarshim have a lot of interpretations about what specifically made him upset, because as Chazal note, this is not the kind of reaction you want to have, right? So that here you have Nebuch, a woman who's suffering, she's barren, and this is a tremendous emotional pain, and for the response of the husband to be angry at her, so this is certainly not the lesson we would want to take away from this. So, different interpretations why he's angry, and among them, for example, the Ramban writes that kind of like emotional blackmail, a little bit, or we call it, you know, halachic blackmail, because the idea that Meisan Ochi, so Rashi sounds like she's saying, I might as well be dead. But the way the Ramban understands it, she's basically saying that I'm going to just collapse from anguish and from grief, or from sadness, and I'm going to die. So basically, she's basically threatening him, saying, give me children, and otherwise I'm going to die. So how is to give her children? So presumably she's saying that you're a tzaddik, and tzaddik, use your tefillah power to give me a child. So he was saying to her, it doesn't work that way. The idea that you can think that a tzaddik can just push the button and get whatever he wants, and so much so that you can threaten me in this way, that got him very upset. And different Mefarshim, different Rishonim had different explanations also about what was bothering him, but it's also from quoting the name of the Akedah Yitzchak, that the Akedah Yitzchak said this whole idea that she was saying that I only exist for children and that I have no value other than that, that was upsetting to him. That yes, it's true that it's a phenomenal bracha to be able to have children, but there's also a tremendous value to your life even if you don't. So to say that if I'm not going to have sons, so then what's my worth? What's my value? So to that he reacted in a visceral way. So, you know, we say that this is not it doesn't seem to us to be the sensitive response the husband would have for a wife who's suffering to such an extent. And certainly the anger is not something we want to imitate. But that idea that he wanted her to appreciate that whether or not she has children, she has tremendous value in and of herself. So that is a point that could be extracted from this, and that's a part of what the Kedis Yitzchak is emphasized. Hi.
Is there a parallel then to be drawn between this story and the beginning of Shmuel Aleph?
Very possibly. There's a lot of parallels between the two of them, so there certainly is what to work with. Yeah. But here we are, just about out of time. We're over time, so maybe things are your turn. All right. Ashrei Yoshua.